Welcome to the Athenaeum Review, where we talk about the ideas that shape our world. I'm Ben Lima, and our guest today is Linda Dalrymple Henderson, Centennial Professor in Art History and Distinguished Teaching Professor at the University of Texas at Austin, and the author of numerous books and articles, including The Fourth Dimension and Non-Euclidean Geometry in Modern Art, republished by MIT Press in 2013 with an extended introduction, and Duchamp in Context, Science and Technology in the Large Glass and Related Works, which won the Robert W. Hamilton Author Award in 1999. And she's received many fellowships, including the Guggenheim, the American Academy in Berlin, and the National Institute of the History of Art in Paris. She's also been a curator, first at the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston, and more recently for the exhibition Reimagining Space, the Park Place Gallery Group in 1960s New York for the Blanton Museum in Austin. And her current work includes a project entitled The Energies of Modernism, Art, Science, and Occultism in the Early 20th Century, which explores the impact of discoveries like X-rays, radioactivity, and the electron on artists' understanding of matter and space. Shortly after giving a talk at the Guggenheim in New York on the artist Hilma af Klint, she's here at UT Dallas to receive the Pioneer Award from Leonardo, the International Society for the Arts, Sciences, and Technology. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Ben. I'm delighted to be here.
I wanted to start by asking about X-rays. It seems that the discovery of X-rays in 1895 really forced people to rethink their understanding of the material world. And I wanted to ask you how artists eventually responded to this new sense of vision that X-rays provided.
It's a wonderful question. And something that was missing from narratives of the history of art was, I would say in general, was this larger scientific background. But as we became more and more accustomed to having X-rays made of our broken bones, we lost, I think, the sense of wonder that the discovery of the X-ray brought in 1895, this suddenly ability to see through matter, to see an inner structure. And particularly in this period, one often sees juxtaposed photographs of a photograph in visible light and then in invisible light, the X-ray, essentially. So you see the skeleton of a rat, for example, and then a very beautiful photograph that captures the fur of this rat. And the sense for artists, I think, that, yes, that's what the Impressionists had been devoted to, was chronicling visible light as accurately as possible. But here, indeed, was a completely other reality that was escaping the human eye, because our retina doesn't receive those vibrations or recognize those vibrations of all the other ranges of the electromagnetic spectrum. So for artists, this was such a liberating event. And we really see it first, I think, having an impact in the context of cubism and as well as futurism. But the sense that, as Baccioni says, the artist must be a clairvoyant, must paint not the visible, but the invisible. Yeah. Becomes a major fascination for artists.
And is it, you know, just thinking about this and listening to you talk about it, is, I don't know if irony is the word, but something about how it's somehow the task of the artist to translate the invisible, or translate the invisible to the visible, or is that a kind of way that they think about trying to make these things that are invisible and make them visible?
I think that's true, and it's that mood essentially is there from the symbolist era onward, where critics like Albert Aurier, for example, writing about Gauguin, suggests that the new artist is a kind of visionary who doesn't fall prey to the illusions of the visible world, which is, in Aurier's view, certainly simply a reflection of some kind of higher reality, Platonic world of ideas, that we are living in some kind of shadow of a true reality, and that it's the artist's goal to try to give form in some way to this invisible reality.
That I think that reminds me of your discussion of how the in the late 19th century the concept of the fourth dimension would have a sometimes a Platonic or a Kantian idealist sense of some realm like that.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's, I think, for artists too, this is another aspect of this freedom, exhilarating freedom from the norms and traditions of art, of painting, of art education, that the X-ray really undercuts the primacy of visible light.
Right.
And which, of course, light and shade, chiaroscuro modeling, all of these things that had dominated painting for hundreds of years, the X-ray does a similar, the fourth dimension does a similar thing, which is to suggest that techniques for rendering three-dimensional space, like Renaissance perspective, are also now outmoded, because if space indeed has four dimensions, it may be the art or the role of the artist also to attempt to render this more complex reality than what the human eye is perceiving.
To wrap my mind around the way that at the present time, probably many people would see the scientific and the occult, spiritualist, theosophy as just so completely opposed, just really antithetical ways of understanding the world. But back 100 years ago, or around 1900, that was not the case, and these were seen as compatible. And the example that really struck me was the comparison of telegraphy and telepathy, that somehow the same way you can send messages using the radio waves, well, you can also send thoughts between people's minds. I guess one way to ask the question would be how what was so different at that time that these seemed to be so well compatible with each other, whereas something happened in the time since then to make them seem so opposite?
Yes, that's also a great question. And I think it's a reminder of what a different world that was in the early 20th century, that indeed these two fields, which we do tend to think of as more separate, are at that moment very interconnected. And it's in part due, I think, to prominent scientists who are interested in both aspects. So Sir Oliver Lodge, who probably is the best known, certainly the most widely published scientist in this period, is a physicist, respected physicist, theorist of the ether of space, but also very interested in spiritualism and telepathy.
Right.
And the whole founding of the Society for Psychical Research in the 1880s is another testament to the fact that scientists are quite interested in these unexplained phenomena. Camille Flammarion, the astronomer, another one of these figures, William Crookes, the chemist. Huh. So it's a moment where it's a much more fluid, shared investigation of the unknown, I think. And part, I would say, of what changes is the coming of World War I and then the popularization of Einstein and relativity theory, which, although it's posited in 1905 and 1915, isn't really known to the public until after 1919, when an eclipse expedition catapults him to celebrity. In the 20s, it's a very different world in the 20s, and that kind of fluidity and openness seems to decline, basically. And the field of psychology, for example, which had been deeply rooted in the study of spiritualist mediums in the 1890s, more and more seeks to establish its professional status and distance itself from this earlier moment. And I think that leads us later in the 20th century to this false sense that somehow the world from the 1920s onward defines the whole 20th century, and the E equals MC squared sums up the science of the 20th century. Whereas indeed, before that point, and the war and the emergence of relativity theory do mark a real division, I think, that have kept us from recovering this larger context, which information on the unknown, this sense of living with an invisible meta-reality around you, is anything that can be gleaned about that seems to be interesting information, especially for artists.
Well, to talk specifically about art and in relation to this connection between the spiritual and the scientific, reading your work on the fourth dimension really helped me to better understand certain artists whose work I think can be frankly sort of baffling. And I'm referring to specifically Malevich and Kandinsky and the way that for example, with Malevich, you explained how his idea of the fourth dimension reflected this idea of a cosmic consciousness a cosmic consciousness from Uspensky that combined math and mysticism. And I guess it sounds like these artists were very aware and very fluent in this kind of scientific or pop scientific discourse.
That's I think, very important point to emphasize, is that with the exception of Marcel Duchamp, who's really reading science textbooks and probably right. the artist most engaged with the new science at this moment, most of these artists are getting this information via the large number of scientific popularizations that are written in this period. So there is an excitement about these new discoveries, X-rays, radioactivity, the electron, et cetera, that makes this information fascinating for the layperson. There are new ways right. of seeing, new ways of communicating. There is a real sense of a changed world.
Yeah.
And so the material is very accessible
yeah.
and in the context of popular scientific articles, but then also in this body of occult literature,
yeah.
which occultists are writing and translating and diffusing, in fact, scientific information,
yeah.
so that it's very easy for Malevich, for example, to be very aware of the new scientific ideas. These books from right. France in particular, or Germany, are being translated into Russian.
Yeah.
So the Russian avant-garde is operating in this same context. And then specifically the fourth dimension, another one of these international ideas, and
yeah.
something I've realized in this research is the international nature of both science and occultism. These
yeah.
national boundaries don't mean anything because work is being translated. So Uspensky's notion of a expanded consciousness, enlarging your consciousness to understand the fourth dimension, reflects a fairly general sense in this period of the evolution of consciousness, that right. just as coming out of Darwinian evolution, the body is seen to be evolving, that the mind also could evolve to a state that more and more can be comprehended or understood, that there yeah. is this possibility of increasing your receptivity by a few wavelengths uh-huh. beyond visible light, you'd be clairvoyant.
Wow.
And it's a very optimistic moment.
Yeah.
And so for artists, the fourth dimension especially is something fascinating to attempt to give form to in
yeah.
some way. And artists approach it in a variety of different ways and would, of course, have given anything for digital technologies and
yeah.
virtual reality.
Wow.
Today, we have capabilities that
yeah.
are so far beyond what, you know, what they could do. But it's an idea, the fourth dimension, that seems never to grow old, and its fascination continues up to the present moment, basically.
Yeah.
This.
Yeah.
There's never a look that becomes old-fashioned. It's just this continuing challenge to try to embody in some way a more complex reality
yeah.
than what the eye is seeing.
The sense that there's something more than, yeah.
yeah.
One thing specifically that really grabbed me in your writing about Malevich was the way that he had used this white background and the idea of the kind of the sensation of infinity, where one is floating freely in an infinite vastness, a freedom from orientation and gravity. And I thought that sounds a little bit like the idea of the sublime, but it's not exactly right.
It's a great observation. I really think in many ways the fourth dimension is the 20th century code name for the sublime.
Okay.
This connection to infinity and
yeah.
that yearning
right.
for something greater that's just beyond our reach,
yeah.
It functions in very parallel ways.
Yeah,
it's a great observation.
So then there's you also explored, as I see it, there's this real contrast between the more subjective and even kind of emotional approach to Bergson and Bergson's philosophy, which is opposed by, for example, Duchamp, with a much cooler approach, as in his 1915 article on Seurat, where he praised the scientific precision and indifference of that artist. And I realized while reading your work that there's something so shocking in The Large Glass, this major work, that the subject of a bride and bachelors, this sense of the subject of kind of reproduction and sexuality and so forth, which is treated in such a cold, mechanical manner, taking something, i.e., if you think of the way that, say, marriage is the subject of how many works of literature and art and so forth, and love and romance and all that stuff, and Duchamp is, I think, treating that subject in this mechanical way, it's very shocking. But at the same time, you point out that he has this idea of playful physics. So there's this combination. Is that right? That there's this sense of both kind of playfulness, but also something even shockingly cold and so forth.
Mm-hmm. And he actually refers to The Large Glass as his hilarious picture. So humor is central to it, but the larger goal there is really to redefine art making as an intellectual endeavor. And he's reacting against that world around him in Paris of the Cubists, and who are deeply engaged with Bergson and believing this is not Picasso and Braque so much, but rather Albert Gleizes and Jean Messager, mm-hmm. the group of Salon Cubists, as mm-hmm. we refer to them. Mark Antliff has written very convincingly about how deeply involved they are with Bergson's philosophy. But for Bergson, the work of art is meant to be this kind of profound self-expression that grows up within the artist. And Bergson even has a quotation where he's rejecting ideas that are mechanical. He even uses the word ready-made, received from the outside, without this profound, deep expression. So Duchamp, who is tired of what he calls later retinal delectation, this beautiful painterly painting like that of Matisse, etc., in which he feels the ideas have been lost. And so this 1915 article, the mention of Seurat as the scientific painter, is very indicative of this sense that art has lost its direction. As he says later, he wants to put it once again at the service of the mind.
Right.
And Leonardo, although he will put a mustache on Leonardo on the Mona Lisa in 1919, is in fact a great hero of his, because Leonardo at that moment is being celebrated as the great intellectual artist scientist even. And Leonardo's notes are being reproduced in facsimile in the 1890s in France. And that one of Duchamp's major activities becomes note making, is definitely a reflection of this way of redefining yourself as a thinking artist, essentially. So The Large Glass is created in this deliberately cool technique. He wants to avoid oil and canvas completely. He's not able to in the end. He works on glass and has to use in the end more paint than he wanted to, but he's outlining forms with lead wire to make this non-arty line. He wants this to remove expression from line making. And the paint is, he's working on the back of the glass, so you never see brush strokes. It's like looking through a laboratory slide, basically. You're looking at paint behind glass. Wow. And that's all very deliberate. And then this narrative that he designs in the notes that he's writing starting in 1912 of a bride who is in control of the situation above these bachelors. She's in a four-dimensional, ethereal kind of realm, and they are clearly in a three-dimensional, gravity-bound realm. Yeah. Their quest for her is a kind of hopeless one, essentially.
Yeah.
But he's using science, and he's using the contrast of 3D and 4D geometry to make this insuperable division between those two halves. Wow.
And you, I think you also point out that in literature, not only Ezra Pound, but in James Joyce's Ulysses, there's some kind of striking parallels right down to this mechanical exercise machine that they both use. That was amazing.
Yeah. I think this is so interesting to see these two masterpieces of the early 20th century.
From right the same time.
The same time, and they're responding to so many of the things in the larger cultural context.
Yeah. One of the things that you've shown in your work is how when we look at science's impact on art and culture, to be aware of the chronology of its reception. So this prime example being Einstein making his discoveries in 1905, but not having them come to wide public consciousness until 1919. So could I ask you to talk about how kind of once this public burst of attention came to Einstein's theory in 1919, what effects did that have among the work of artists and so forth?
It's so interesting to look at how old an artist is in 1919, because there are younger artists, and I think specifically of Moholy Nagy at the Bauhaus, who respond immediately with great excitement about this new paradigm of Einstein, who redefines the spatial fourth dimension, which artists had been questing for, as time, that now, and following Hermann Minkowski, who proposes in 1908 this space-time continuum of three dimensions of space and one of time, which will be fused together and make it possible to kind of unify the viewpoints of all the frames of reference that Einstein makes relative when he says there is no single absolute space, but each of these frames of reference is equally valid. Then the space-time continuum developed by Minkowski or proposed comes into being, and with this sense now that time has to be integrated with the three spatial dimensions. But what that does is then remove this notion of a spatial fourth dimension.
Right.
And that idea had been so stimulating to artists' imaginations.
Right.
And suddenly time is the fourth dimension and space-time is the watchword.
Right.
And so artists begin to explore time.
Right.
So we have Gabo in Russia making his space-time construction, and then Moholy Nagy especially embracing this idea of kinetic art and his great light space modulator that's made later in the decade of the 20s. That certainly becomes, during the course of the 20s, more and more talk about the fourth dimension as time, and that's picked up after World War II in the 40s. Moholy publishes his book Vision in Motion in 1947. And that really codifies for mid-century what the fourth dimension is. So in the 50s, Vision in Motion was required reading in any art school. I think the University of Texas had maybe five copies on the shelf. But it's a wonderful codification of modernism. It's a wonderful book, and include talking about Joyce at the end of it, actually. But the association of the fourth dimension with kinetic art then is very strong, and including in the 50s in Paris. And it's interesting because Alexander Calder is part of this, obviously pioneer of kinetic art, and part of this rhetoric about space-time. And there's just a Calder show has just opened in Montreal. And I wrote an essay for that catalog on Calder and Duchamp, who are actually very good friends. And it's interesting that at mid-century, Duchamp is also being talked about as a kinetic artist because of the bicycle wheel and then the rotary glass plates and the discs, etc. And for him, this was, I think, frustrating because people had forgotten this spatial fourth dimension to which he had devoted himself in the large glass, as well as indeed the ether physics of the pre-relativity physics of the early years of the century. And so it's interesting to watch him kind of pushing back against that a bit, publishing a note on the fourth dimension in 1948 and trying to talk about this idea of the bride as four-dimensional, as a shadow. He has many interesting ideas in his notes, which significantly he doesn't release until 1966, his specific notes on the fourth dimension, of the bride as the shadow, compression on a two-dimensional surface of a three-dimensional bride who's the shadow of the true four-dimensional bride. And he's clearly watching what actually is a kind of resurgence of interest in the old fourth dimension by the late 1950s. Martin Gardner is writing about this idea in Scientific American. Books are being reprinted by Dover Books at this point. And so he decides, in fact, in 66 to publish his books that dealt, or his notes, I should say, that dealt with the fourth dimension. He had published a set of notes about the large glass in 34, but he had There's only one passing reference to the fourth dimension there. He realizes he doesn't have an audience that will understand those notes. But by the 60s, the idea is coming back. Yeah. And so those are released, and they are so rich, even for artists today. He's talking about virtual images and really prescient kind of thinking. And one imagines what he might have done with virtual reality technologies. I also think hypertext would have been the perfect thing for him, because he never wanted to put his notes in a particular order.
Oh, amazing.
It would have been ideal.
Yeah. And this was also the time when you'd cited, I think, also Siegfried Gideon's space, time, and architecture as so according to that kind of approach, all of this leads right to international style architecture, right? Like Gropius and...
Right. And the tricky thing about Gideon is that it's clearly embracing the Einstein paradigm, but then Gideon is one of those first people who tries to suggest that cubism had something to do with Einstein. So he has that little chronology of 1905, special theory of relativity, 1907, Picasso's Demoiselles d'Avignon. And as I began my graduate work, that was really what I was working against, was this body of literature in the 40s and 50s that's trying to validate cubism by linking it to Einstein in some way, and then misses completely the fact that there's another kind of science that's prominent in that earlier period.
I also wanted to talk about the Park Place Gallery, which was active in Soho in New York from 1963 to 67, with artists including Mark de Suvero, David Novaros, Robert Grosvenor, Ronald Bladen, among others. And in your exhibition catalog, you explore a few different terms or concepts that could apply to their work, including romanticism, expressionism, and even mannerism. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about kind of the aesthetic qualities of the Park Place artists and how these terms fit in.
Okay. And just to clarify, Ron Bladen was a very good friend of theirs, but he's actually not a member of the group. They were a group of artists, ended up being five painters and five sculptors who had come together in 1962 and a number of them coming from California and then a couple joining from New York, who had a building at on Park Place, the future site of the World Trade Center, which they could rent very cheaply. So they sort of took over this building and established a gallery on the top floor where they just were sharing their work with each other, basically. And it really began to be an item. A lot of people were coming downtown to see this work. And ultimately, they lost that building ultimately because the World Trade Center construction began, lost it in 64, and they then reopen in 65 at 546 West Broadway in the first large ground floor gallery in New York.
Right.
It's really revolutionary, and they had big goals of wanting to make large-scale sculpture and painting, and this was an exciting chance to do that with this interesting arrangement of incorporating essentially as the Park Place Gallery of Art Research with Paula Cooper, who initially was the assistant director but became their director. But they formed a corporation and found backers. So Patrick Lannan, the CEO of AT&T, Virginia Dwan, Vera List, and then two Dallas oilmen's wives, Betty Guyverson Blake and Luby Murchison, who paid quarterly support payments, and then at the end of the year each got a work from each of the artists. And the interesting thing that I discovered them, because Robert Smithson talks about Park Place at the end of his very famous Entropy in the New Monuments article, and Harry refers to them as a space-time monastic order. They were a really interesting collaborative. They were all fascinated by the fourth dimension.
Yeah.
So, and it's a testament to the multivalence of that term that it means different things for different artists. So Mark de Suvero, who absolutely comes out of the tradition of kinetic art, deeply engaged with Einstein and the idea of space-time, making his kinetic sculpture. But in 1957, Peter Farrakis, one of the California artists, had discovered in an artist's book sale at the California School of Fine Arts a copy of Uspensky's Tertium Organum, which was owned by Adeline Kent, a California artist. And it was like finding this ancient wisdom. Here was this other fourth dimension that had nothing to do with Einstein. Yeah. It was this cosmic consciousness, basically. Yeah. And so he shared it with Dean Fleming. And as the group came together then, Peter really picked up on the geometry, and he's of Greek heritage, and one felt sort of Euclid in his bones, essentially his DNA. Such a wonderful geometer, but not Euclidean geometry, but a complex four-dimensional geometry. But Dean Fleming really took the Uspensky book to heart and really wanted to make paintings that would produce a experience of cosmic consciousness or expanded consciousness of some kind. And then so there was the space-time, the geometry, the mysticism, and then for Frosty Myers and Leo Valador, Buckminster Fuller is a major hero in this period. And he's one of the people who's contributing to this recurrence of interest in the spatial fourth dimension, because his synergetic geometry based on the tetrahedron is something he's promulgating by the 40s. And he's in the 60s giving lectures saying, people may have told you the fourth dimension is time, but it's not, it's space.
Yeah.
So this was very important. And between Fuller and ideas about outer space, there's also a kind of cosmic quality that develops in terms of outer space. In so many ways fulfills what people had said the experience of the fourth dimension would be. You'd be free of your sense of gravity, left and right orientation, floating in this infinite vastness, this kind of sublime infinite vastness. So there's a connection to science fiction and outer space as well. So they stage a show in the spring of 65 called 4D.
Yeah.
No one knew that. And it was, you know, this wonderful recovery, and the chance to do that exhibition was fantastic. The work looked so beautiful and so fresh.
Yeah. You'd also referred to the composer Terry Riley, and especially Aldous Huxley's book, The Doors of Perception, and the reference to William Blake and this kind of, I don't know if you call it ecstasy or transcendental consciousness, or as I think Arthur Danto saying, this longing for another world. My thought was that this kind of attitude is well known, let's say, in maybe the more pop culture, like kind of psychedelia, and obviously the band The Doors and so forth. But the story of kind of sculpture of that period is not usually connected with that. So it was really amazing.
Yeah, it's a great point. And actually, Steve Reich had his first concert in New York at Park Place. They were functioning as they considered themselves a research center, and they were having dance performances, showing films, and then the Reich concerts. And Terry Riley's a great example of this. You know, rejecting the term minimalism.
Yeah.
And of course, this is what happens to the story of Park Place, is by New York had been such an ecumenical place. And then by 67, and in the wake of Primary Structures, there are these boundaries drawn in New York that are very strict. And the gallery closes in 67 because between Clement Greenberg's focus on flatness in painting and the increasing emphasis on specific objects and minimalism generally, the sculpture is too complex, and the paintings, which are really about complex spatial experiences, are out of tune, essentially, with this growing paradigm. So I think Terry Riley mentions this interest in transcendence. And so recovering this sense of the complexity of the New York art world, narrative as it has been told of the 60s, and you see it in every museum you visit. There's a minimalist room. It's as if this embodies the 60s.
Yeah.
It's just part of that story. And the fact that these artists are so, they are kind of referred to as too romantic. But they are really...
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Exactly. No, that's the point, I think. They are visionaries, and they have a message to share. And why, indeed, things had to be narrowed down to this very simple form language it was a cruel trick of history, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, I was kind of thinking about that, because certainly when I studied this period, I essentially learned it from the point of view of Donald Judd and Robert Morris and so forth. And you'd cited, so there at the Primary Structures Symposium, for this show that included both the kind of Judd camp and the Park Place group, that Judd was very critical of de Souvarow at that symposium. And then there was an article by Mel Bochner in 1996, which was very critical. And I was thinking, well, so why did it turn out this way? Is it just because Judd and Bochner and Morris wrote so much so that people who are learning this period by reading about it will pick up what they wrote, and that's why they sort of got the upper hand? Or, I mean, why do you think it sort of turned out as it did? Just because people read what Judd has to say and say, okay, that's...
there were powerful critical voices
that
coalesced around those artists.
Yeah.
And Park Place, as Dean Fleming has said, nobody could say what we were.
Right.
That was our strength, and that was a strength, but they also didn't have a label.
Yeah, yeah.
And had Lucio Fontana not taken the name Spatialism, it would have been an excellent moniker for them.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting aspect of history at that moment, this desire to kind of control that narrative, and which is definitely there.
Yeah.
And so the story becomes much simplified. Minimalism wins the day.
Yeah.
And so Dean Fleming goes off to Colorado. Yeah. And they'd had a big show in Denver in an unfinished skyscraper that was the daughter, Vera List's daughter, had a connection to that. So they drove a truck of their work across to Denver. And Dean really heard the call of the Colorado mountains. And so he, when the gallery closed, he went to Colorado, built a Buckminster Fuller dome, and founded a community, Libre, which is still exists. And he is still painting in his Fuller dome. And just as visionary and wonderful as ever.
Yeah.
But these were painters who, Ed Ruta, stayed in New York, stayed in his same studio, and just kept painting. They were so committed to their art that even though the market, you know, was dissolving essentially for their work, they continued to make it. And and so it was wonderful to do that show. And then since that time, the Downtown Gallery show that was at NYU. There's a growing interest in recovering, I think, the complexity of this moment.
One of Judd's criticisms of de Souvarow had been that it was anthropomorphic and expressionistic. And then reading about the success of this show in Denver, and then also the show at MIT, and thinking of the way, you know, we have these major de Souvarow sculptures here in Dallas and the Arts District downtown. And, you know, I was thinking, well, maybe the anthropomorphic expressionistic aspect, I mean, maybe that's what reaches the public. Maybe that's why they liked it, you know?
I think there's a sense, certainly among graduate students now working on the 60s, real interest in de Souvarow and this fact, what's wrong with anthropomorphism? I mean, in other words, that's one particular view, but it's not a reason to deride other sculptors working in other ways. So that he's a remarkable sculptor and such a brilliant mind and a real poet and a remarkable writer. And for so long, his work was kind of sidelined by the symposium, the Primary Structure Symposium. And I think he, at that point, he says to Judd, I don't think what you're doing is art because you're not making it yourself.
Right,
and obviously that's going to change. And that's Mark's view. But it didn't mean that Judd's work wasn't valid. You know, the same thing, I think we have to be a bit more open about possibilities and that it need not be one exclusive thing. So Mark's work, he's installed a piece at the University of Texas as well and part of a landmark sculpture program. And it's such a beautiful work, which he really intends for students to move around, lie under, interact with in this way, sort of recover the inner child in them. And they are works that bring great joy, this beautiful red element injected into the science campus where everything was brown, I think. He's so inspiring in this regard. And for him, manipulating those beams was a crucial part of making these works.
Yeah.
And I think we can now look back and see indeed a range of possibilities.
Yeah.
We need not close it down quite so fully.
Definitely. Wow. Well, this is the Athenaeum Review podcast, where we talk about the ideas that shape our world. Andrew O is our engineer, and the Athenaeum Review podcast is produced by Creative Disturbance and the School of Arts and Humanities at UT Dallas. Find out more at creativedisturbance.org.